And I want to have Jay Billis on so that we can put it online and then people can listen to it up until the start of college basketball, because he'll tell us what the situation is. Ever since NIL hit, I thought the game was done. Jay Billis said, calm down, Homer. It's okay. It's okay. And I'm wondering if he's going to say the same thing now that schools are now paying players. Jay Billis, good evening.
Good evening, Homer. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm actually very happy because this is what I need and what I think college sports fans need. Though I do have one problem. I'm not sure how to introduce you. I saw that when you did the draft, they said you were a four-time starter at Duke. And then, I don't know. And then you were a finalist. I mean, you were starting center in the NCAA championship game against Louisville. And I thought, no, what it should be there is, and I can't remember if you took on Barney, the big purple dinosaur, or you defended him. But as a lawyer, did you defend him or go against him?
I was against him.
Correct.
Barney, the people that owned Barney the Purple Dinosaur back in the, I don't know, mid to late 90s were suing people all over the country to try to protect their trademark and copyright. So I represented one of the companies that was being sued by Barney. So we basically fought off the evil purple dinosaur and actually wound up winning at the trial level. So it was interesting. And the problem was, Homer, my kids were little at the time, so they were Barney fans. And I had to listen to that nonsense all day long or all night long. And then I'd go to work and I had it as my main gig for about, I don't know, 6 months. The trial took a while preparing for it. And then the appeal, at the Fourth Circuit level. So it was a lot of Barney that I probably didn't need at that time in my life.
All right. So maybe I'll think joining us now is Jay Billis. He took on and whipped Barney, the big purple dinosaur, many years ago in another life as a successful attorney. Jay, good evening. How does that sound?
It sounds great. It's good to be with you again.
All right, let's just start with the facts. You had this court case, and now it's been resolved. Or what are the facts of what's going on, and what is the situation as college sports get started with first football and then basketball?
Well, I mean, I guess you could go to the nuts and bolts of there was a case called House versus the NCAA and the five major conferences in college sports, and it was an antitrust case which alleged that all of the NCAA institutions and the five conferences had essentially colluded to put an illegal wage ceiling on players, and that wage ceiling was at zero. They weren't allowed to be paid by the schools or any other entity beyond what the NCAA allowed with a scholarship and a stipend and the like. And I think the NCAA realized pretty quickly that they were going to lose that case. So they wound up reaching a settlement with the plaintiffs, and it was a class action antitrust case. And so as part of the settlement, NCAA and the conferences are paying $2.8 billion in back damages to athletes as part of the class going back to, I think, 2016. I don't know exactly what the breakdown of how that money is going to be paid out and to whom and how much to each person. It'll differ depending on the value that each player or each athlete may have brought. And then there's a forward-looking component of the settlement that allows schools now to pay athletes up to $20.5 million per school in the first year. And that amount goes up by, I think, is an escalator of 4% per year for the first couple years. And then they recalculate the revenues that are coming in to make sure that the players are getting the fair value of what is now the $20.5 million going forward. So there's an argument to be made that that's going to make things cleaner and easier. So the collectives are not as big a part of this, even though the collectives are still going to exist and players can still make money in third-party NIL. But the schools now theoretically consign players to contracts. So you can sign a player to a take Marquette, for example, and we'll use Cam Jones because he's already gone. But if Shaka were recruiting Cam Jones now, they could say, hey, Cam, we want to sign you to a 4-year deal or a 3-year deal with an option for a fourth year. here's what we're going to pay you, but there's going to be a buyout in there, and there are going to be conditions on academic performance and things like that. You can certainly do that. And that would help alleviate some of the transfer concerns that that many people have, because, you know, when a player is not being paid and not under contract and not acting as an employee, they can't tell them they can't transfer. That would be an antitrust, or could very well be seen as an antitrust violation and be illegal itself. So you sign them to a contract just like you would Shaka Smart, and it makes it, you put a buyout in there, it makes it much more difficult, much more costly to leave.
Talking with Jay Billis, is that occurring yet?
Yes, it is. I can't speak, Homer, to, you know, how many players are currently being signed to contracts. I know there was a lot going on leading up to the settlement of schools trying to reach deals with collectives, with players, to get those deals in place before the settlement was reached, so they could actually pay the players a little bit more than they would be able to otherwise. That's just a function of there not being a settlement in place when those deals were reached. But going forward, I think we're going to see that. I think you're going to see contracts being signed, and that gives everybody, including the players, a little more certainty as to what these deals are going to be, and it'll allow some retention. What you're also going to see as part of the settlement, Homer, is schools, like roster sizes are going to be reduced. So everybody will be allowed a scholarship now in any sport, but the amount of roster spots is going to be reduced. So football have 85, basketball have like 13 or whatever it is. And so you'll see fewer spots available. So life may be different for future walk-ons. There won't be as many walk-on spots, things like that. They'll still exist. But, you know, if you were a walk-on at Kentucky, maybe you'll have to be a player at Ball State or something like that. You may see things like that happen.
Talking with Jay Billis, I ask you this every time we've talked, and that is, should people be worried? What do you want to tell the average college fan about what's the same, what's different? Every time we've talked, you've always said, calm down, Homer. They're making, if I have this right, $16 billion. They'll figure out a way. That's what happens when you make that much money. Did I have correct?
Yeah, except for the amount. They're making way more than $16 billion. Okay. I mean, it's such a multi-billion-dollar entertainment industry. Well, you know, and I don't mean to be snarky when I ask this, but I would ask any fan to say, why do you care what the players make? And you know, because you didn't.
I can answer that. I can answer
that. Okay.
Jay, I've followed college sports, and I understand not everybody goes to class, but they were like student athletes. There was a connection to that person and the university. Right now, they're pros. Like, I'm Homer. As much as I like Marquette basketball, I'm as much as a student athlete at Marquette as those basketball players are. And that doesn't feel right. That's not the world it's been. They're just professionals that are representing Marquette, which is fine, but it's so different. And your response is...
My response would be it may be different, but they were pros before, by that definition, they've never been student athletes. There's no such thing as a student athlete.
I agree with that. But look at the guy's making $1 million. I don't feel a connection if I'm a student with him. I don't know. Do you feel a connection with a 19-year-old? And, you know, how would you have been? What feeling would you have had with the other students at Duke if you're walking around as a freshman making $1 million?
It would have been the same. Okay. Except I would have had money in my pocket instead of being scrounging around for the money to buy a pizza. And, you know, like, if we're so worried about that, why don't we restrict every student from making any money while they're in school? Like, Mark Zuckerberg didn't have a problem making money while he was at Harvard.
Correct.
And nobody seemed to worry about that. Look, this is a little bit different. And I realize in our society, we have a thing where people say, well, I'd be happy getting just this. You know, why do you want more than that? I get that, but you don't have to take the money if you don't want to. And if you're happy not making it yourself, then you don't take it. None of this stuff. I guess I have the biggest problems with this whole thing, saying, all right, we all want the players to have the college experience and to have things the way they were back in the 1960s or 1970s, at least the way we thought they were and the way it was sold to us. But the way it was sold to us was a lie. These players, whether they're paid or not, are employees of the university. Okay. And each school has to decide the standard to which they're going to hold their athletes and all their students. As long as the players are doing their homework and getting their degrees, why do we care whether they make money or not? To me, I don't care, because it didn't seem to bother anybody. You know, when I played for Coach K at Duke, he probably made $100,000 a year. Later on in his career, he was making 10 plus million a year, and nobody seemed to have a problem with that because of how big college sports got. And they were like, well, wait a minute, this is making a lot of money, therefore he deserves it. Why don't the players deserve it? And to me, if you want to run the business this way, you have to acknowledge that the players have a tremendous amount of value, and we're seeing that now. Now that they can be compensated, they are being compensated. The market is speaking. And what I see, Homer, and look, there will always be cases where in any endeavor people make money and they don't make the right decisions with it. We can make the same argument about driving. Some people don't drive as well as they should. They don't maintain their cars. You know, they drive under the influence. They make mistakes doing that. But the overwhelming majority of people who drive do just fine. And the overwhelming majority of athletes that make money are benefiting, not being a problem with it. So, you know, all the games are played on time. We've had great years the last several. We had the best NCAA tournament we've had in a long time, and guys were making a lot of money. And they're benefiting from it. They're savvier now. They've got, you know, sort of financial acumen now. They're learning about business, and they're generating wealth. And why should we restrict them from that? I just don't see a good reason. If we want this to be like it was 50 years ago, then Marquette and Duke and all these other places should run their programs like Division II. And they don't. They want the big money themselves. The universities want it. The coaches want it. The administrators want it. Nobody's pulled back. Nobody said, hey, I'm out. Like, I'm not doing this. We'll be like the University of Chicago, and we're going to go Division II. Nobody's done that. Like, Ohio State is not playing Amherst in the shoe for free admission because this offends their sensibilities. Everybody's all in on this, and the players deserve their share of it. I've always felt that way. I felt that way when I was a player, and I feel that way now.
I'm certainly in that camp and have been for a long time. The reason I brought that up is I think the only concern or worry would be that fans won't be as attracted to it. It's clear they don't have any problem with whatever has existed the last few years at all. So if the fans still want to see their schools with the players representing the school or however you want to describe them, everything's great. I just thought there might be a certain fan group, a percentage that says this isn't college sports. This is professional sports. It's like AAA baseball, and nobody's making the kind of money in AAA baseball. And we know that's because people feel a great affinity and love for the school they went to. But if fans like it, then it's going to keep making billions, and that's fine.
And it is. And it is. And we've seen the last few years, fans haven't turned away. There are actually more viewers than we had prior to NIL. At least the ratings have been up. And interest has been up in football and men's basketball and women's basketball and in other sports. So it clearly doesn't bother anybody. And like, if it didn't bother anybody when these conferences were signing multi-billion dollar TV contracts, and I hear, you know, the point that you make quite a bit. You know, this is like minor league baseball right now, and I'll push back on that a bit, saying, no, this is like major league baseball. Like, minor leagues don't have multi-billion dollar television contracts.
Right, there's no interest.
They pay their coaches millions of dollars. This has been a major league sport
for decades. But the schools have never paid them before. NIL, everybody else was a ruse. It was really paying the players. But right now is the first time that schools have ever directly paid the players. Right. And now it may make no impact on the fans again, but it is different this year than has ever happened before. Right.
It's different. But like to the earlier point, you know, it's like, why do you care? Like, you know, you don't care how much assistant coaches make. You know, nobody's boycotting over. It doesn't matter. What difference does it matter? Every student can make whatever they can earn in the marketplace.
That is correct.
Restricted.
Yeah.
The only person restricted was an athlete. And, you know, my daughter went, when she was in college, she was a professional artist. She still is, but she made money while she was in school and was celebrated for it. She wasn't making millions of dollars, but it's the same principle. These guys are worth a lot of money, and there's no reason, like, they're still being restricted. Like this $20.5
That was
million
going to be my next
for every
question.
athlete. Yeah, this is not going to last very long. This probably, I think, and I'm just guessing at this, but I think the NCAA has probably got 5 years to figure out a long-term structure. And there's one of two ways I believe they can go. They can either bargain collectively with the players, like the NFL and the NBA do, where the
They don't want
players
to do
agree
that.
to a structure. Well, I don't know why they wouldn't,
All
because the
right.
players would agree to a structure. Or they can go to Congress and beg Congress, which they're doing
Yeah.
right now. They're lobbying Congress for a law that a federal law that would sort of preempt all these state laws and take them out of antitrust scrutiny. Yeah, maybe they'll be successful there, but that's their best shot. But what I think will happen is once they get in front of Congress is going to ask them, well, wait a minute, if we're going to restrict the players, we should be restricting the coaches and the administrators too. So say goodbye to all those $10 million salaries. We're going to make this reasonable too. If you want reasonableness with among the players, you're going to get reasonableness across the board.
Talking with Jay Billis, and I could take it for 3 hours, but I won't. How is anybody, now we're talking about being fans, how can anybody know if a team's going to be good? How do you judge recruiting? What, I mean, you're following the basketball now in the SEC, which some would argue is the greatest conference ever. I don't think it is. When the ACC and other conferences had eight teams and all eight were great and players lasted longer. They didn't have, they were just so, to me, so much better, but that just means I'm old, I guess. You want to agree with me on
Yeah,
that?
I actually think that does mean that you and I are old. That I think a lot of people look back on the old days when we were younger as being better automatically. And I happen to believe the SEC this last year was the best conference in the history of college basketball. There have been other years where you could argue the top four teams were better than last year, but you've never seen a league that
Okay.
had 16 teams across the board that were that good. It was remarkable what they did. Now, will they do it again this year? I don't know. Your point is a fair one about, you know, how do we know who's going to be good? But the truth is, like, I'm a football fan, but I don't follow it religiously. I have no idea who's going to be good
Think you're
every
the
year.
same teams
Yeah, you could, but, well, not
based on the
always. I mean, we're
coaches?
seeing, yeah, well, sometimes, but we're seeing a lot of change in football because you can't stockpile players anymore.
Yeah.
You know, the backups that used to go to Alabama and be content to be a backup for a period of time are now going to Texas A&M or somewhere else for a bigger payday, and we're seeing talent spread out more. So it doesn't mean that the mid-majors are going to be as powerful as the power conference schools, but it means that every power conference school has a better opportunity to be really good now than they had 5 years ago, because we're seeing the talent spread out. But it's just principles of economics. So, like, it's funny. Like, just take basketball for an example. 2 years ago, San Diego State and Florida Atlantic made the Final Four. And the narrative was the earth is flat now. The mid-majors can compete with the big shots. We're going to see a transformation in college basketball. And last year, all four number one seeds from major conferences made it to the Final Four. And the narrative was it's over for the mid-majors. The rich are going to get richer and all that. Well, how is there that much change in 1 year? You know, one data point doesn't make a trend. So I think we need to wait a little bit longer to make those grand pronouncements. But I think what we're going to see going forward is a little bit more stability, because you can sign players to long-term contracts, a little less transferring because you'll be able to hold them to their contracts if the will is there to do that. And I think it'll actually make things a little bit better. But it's never going to be the same. And I don't, like, to me, that's a good thing, but reasonable minds can differ on that. If people liked it better in the 1960s, great. But you know, there were some problems in the 60s that, you know, went beyond whether players were paid or not. And I think there's a little bit of nostalgia to, well, you know, this is different than it was when
No,
I was a
this is going
kid.
to
Well,
be the
of course
most
it's
honest
different.
it's ever been.
Yes, I think so. But you know, look, the college sports has been chasing the money for a long time, and I don't have a problem with that. I have a problem with chasing the money and pretending like you're not. And that's what everybody was doing. There was this idea that, you know, look what we're offering, this great experience to young people and all. And that's great. They do that. But, you know, with 9 o'clock games on Wednesday and all this travel all over the place and playing more games, and they act like this is about academics.
11 a.m. football. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it was about money from the beginning. And that's fine. But don't tell the players that, hey, we're doing you this big favor while you're traipsing them all over the place and restricting what they can earn or accept.
Talking with Jay Billis. All right, 20.5 million. Title IX, I just said there's no way women are going to get half the money. Now, maybe you alluded to everybody's going to get scholarships, but I don't know if Title IX says that. You can help me on that. But there's no way, zero, that women are going to get half of the money.
They may not. But that's going to be up to each school how they dole out their $20.5 million, and then how they want to act in the third-party NIL market. Title IX, to my understanding and my reading of it, does not suggest that everybody has to be paid the same or the exact same amount has to go toward women's sports as goes toward men. Does anybody think that that women's coaches make as much as men's coaches? They don't.
Right.
And so there'll be challenges there, and there'll be lawsuits, and a lot of this will be worked out in the courts, and maybe that.
But the attempt will be equal number of scholarships, I assume. Would that be the approach that they'll go with and hope to?
Well, women actually get more scholarships in certain sports than men do, right?
But I mean,
now,
at a school, you give so many to men, so many to women.
Yeah, and there are mechanisms to stay in compliance with Title IX. I think a lot of Title IX observers will say that most schools are not in compliance with Title IX provisions as we speak. But, you know, you can certainly, you know, devote the same amount of resources to men's sports and women's sports and all that stuff. It doesn't mean you have to pay the women's basketball players the exact same amount you pay the men's or football players versus lacrosse, you know, women's lacrosse or field hockey, things like that. So there are decisions to be made there. There may be some short-term decisions made where they say, hey, look, how many sports do we need? You know, when I was in school, I think Duke had 13 varsity sports. Now Duke has close to 30. What's the right number? You know, I don't know what the right number is. SEC schools have 18, and nobody seems to be complaining that that's unfair when the Ivy League has over 30. Like, what's the right thing? My thing is let everybody do what they feel is best for them. And if you want to pay your players millions, go ahead. If you want to pay them less, go ahead. Like, there's no requirement that everybody pays their coaches $10 million, their football coach. Everybody seems to be able to operate in their own space and say, this is who we are. And I think that's the same thing they should do with regard to paying athletes. You don't want to pay, don't pay. But let's get out of this idea that we should have a restriction across the board. Because that's what got us into this mess, are these illegal restrictions that the courts finally called BS on, and the NCAA lost all their legal protections.
All right, you said $20.5 million. They're saying the top football teams are spending more than that. What is that inaccurate?
Well, they did before this because it was done through the collectives and all that stuff, and you did it through the NIL thing. So that'll change a little bit. There might be a scenario where because of the $20.5 million cap that the schools can pay, players are seen to be making a little bit less, but you still have the third-party NIL space, and that's going to be the most interesting thing. Right now, there's a new enforcement mechanism where Deloitte is handling this as an independent third party, but to the NCAA. But each NIL deal is going to have to be blessed by Deloitte and enforced by this new NCAA entity to make sure that they're market-based. So it can't be this pay-for-play thing. But I think we're going to see that go the way of the dodo bird pretty quickly because, you know, the House settlement didn't address that. And I don't think that's going to work. I think if somebody wants to pay a player, they should be allowed to pay the player. I don't care what it's for. You know, they tell me all the things that, like, all the questions that we have of players, are we asking those same questions of coaches and administrators? Like, when the AD at a big-time school goes to play golf at a fancy club on a private plane with their donors, is anybody saying, hey, can't do that? Nobody's saying that. And we're not policing what commercials John Calipari is doing at Arkansas or John Shire is doing at Duke. Nobody's asking what car they're driving or what watch they're wearing. But we seem to still do that with players. Maybe because it's so new, but I think we need to stop doing that. It's nobody's business.
So the bottom line would be you'd say the same thing before. Homer, be a little made different. Right? It's fine. People still love it. Long as they love it, that's what creates the money. And it would appear that people are still loving basketball, football, and other sports have started to draw some fans. And it's that simple. And it'll be fine. Is that?
I think it will be, Homer. But it sort of goes to this thing like for some reason, when the players were deemed amateur, even though I don't think they were, but when they were deemed amateur, we had this sort of veil of purity over things and say, well, they're really there just to get an education. And that wasn't true. They're there to get an education and to play ball and to make the school money and make the enterprise money. So I don't look at it any differently that when a coach is making a ton of money, that do they not care anymore? Do they not care about relationships? They're just in it for the money. Do they not relate well with their colleagues in the athletic department? None of that makes any sense. Like education and money are not mutually exclusive. I think players still, whether they're now being paid, they still strive to be great teammates. They still want to win. They still want to have careers beyond this. The principles are basically the same, and it's just different. And I think a lot of people have a hard time wrapping their heads around it. You know, they still work hard. All the values and principles of the game are the same. None of that's changed. And the things that get rewarded, like the championships and winning, you know, money's not going to affect that. I don't have a problem. You know, you go to an NFL game, people aren't sitting there going, well, that guy's making more than the other guy. This isn't fair. They don't do that.
But they're going to start doing that in college. They're not going to say overrated. They're going to say overpaid. Like, this information is going to be, no, I know, fine. It's just, it's going to be different. This information about how much players are making is going to be public. Everybody's going to know, or is that premise wrong?
I don't know the answer to that. It may be public in public institutions. It may be private at private institutions. I don't know. And honestly, I don't care. Like, if people want to chant, you know, like, if they want to chant overpaid versus overrated, go ahead, because nobody really cares about the overrated chant. And if I'm making a bunch of money, I don't care what some fan says, because they were gonna be mad at me if I didn't play well, whether I was paid or not. I would rather get paid and have them mad. Because none of that matters. It's like fans can say whatever they want and they can like whatever they want. I'm not trying to talk them out of it. But fair is fair. And this system has been not only unfair, it's been immoral and illegal for 100 years. And at least now that's in the rearview mirror.
All right. Last question has nothing to do with college basketball, but you spent a lot of time working on the draft. And I have no idea if anybody's good other than Cooper Flagg. You looked at all these people, and he just dominated everything. So who else was drafted, or who else is entering the league this year that you would want to say, watch these people?
I would say Dylan Harper from Rutgers, who went number 2 to San Antonio. He's going to be a great player. VJ Edgecombe, who's with Philly, was taken, I think, number 3 by Philly. Mm-hmm. And then Trey Johnson, who was taken 5th by Washington, is probably the best shooter in last year's draft. There were a bunch of good players in that draft. Cooper Flagg took up a lot of the oxygen because he was National Player of the Year. He had a lot of the attention. But I don't think anybody in the league thought that there weren't other players that were going to be truly outstanding in that draft. And the next one coming up this next year is probably even better at the top. But, it was a great draft. And we saw, like, one of the things we saw is there were a lot more freshmen than we've had in past years that were drafted in the first round. And then in the second round, you had a lot of older guys because a lot of players have been staying in school because of NIL. They're allowed to make money, and they're going when they're going to be drafted at a really high level or when they're ready. And that wasn't the case earlier. They were coming in earlier so they could make money. But now they're willing to stay in school longer, and that not only helps everybody's education, pursuit of education, but it also helps the quality of play in college to have them in school longer.
And what excites you the most about what you do?
I love basketball. So, you know, my family situation dictated I couldn't remain in coaching. So it was the next best thing. I mean, I understand. I get it. I'm a broadcaster. I don't look at myself that way. I think of myself more as a basketball person that's enjoying the game and being around the game by being a broadcaster. But, you know, I still run a basketball camp, still teach. I'm immersed in the game. So I guess the answer to your question is what excites me is I love basketball. To me, it's the greatest sport ever invented, with golf number two, because golf allows you to be intoxicated and, destroy private property. That's a good deal.
Yeah. You know, John Anderson from ESPN. I know you do, right?
Of course. Yeah. John's a great friend.
Did you know, and are you surprised to know that he high jumped 7'2.5"?
He might have fallen off of a fence that was 7'2.5". He actually got over a 7'2" bar.
John Anderson.
I did not know that.
And I tell, this is just wrong. Everybody who's at ESPN or anybody comes on, John Anderson, he high jumped 7'2.5". He gets upset when I bring it up, but that's impressive to me. 7'2.5".
That's incredibly impressive.
Yes.
I did not know. I thought he was just as earthbound as I was. That is incredible.
Yeah, so tell the world. Thanks, Jay. And when you want to give us an update that needs to be done, please do so. I think it's necessary and it helps. I don't care what everybody else says. I want them to know because this is what they say. Homer, how's it going to be? I said, Jay Billis says it'll be fine. That's the end of the discussion. So,
all right, brother.
Take
I look
care.
Forward to coming back on with you soon.
You bet.
Thank you.
Uh-huh, bye. And I actually wanted to say the man who whooped Barney the dinosaur, Jay Billis, but I don't think he really he doesn't care, but I think
it's not one of his higher accolades, I would think.
Yes, I think he doesn't view it as impressive as I do, or maybe it's not impressive, it's kind of an odd thing. Yeah. What was it like to take on all the defenders of the people with Barney the dinosaur? You can't do that. Next.